Hello, good evening, and welcome to the North Oakland Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Gren, and I'm an alcoholic and tonight's secretary. Hi, guys. Please turn off your cell phones. Please help me to open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Okay, this is a speaker meeting. I'll speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Mary, who will share her experience, strength, and hope. It says, speak for 10 minutes, please stand. Hi, I'm Gren, I'm an alcoholic. AA has given me a life. Some days I think that's a problem. We're getting our Christmas on over at my house. Getting the tree, getting the lights on the tree. And it's all very festive, and it's also seeming like a great big pain in the ass. Getting the presents and figuring out what everybody wants and getting that. It was getting a bit wound up about it. So I took myself down memory lane to Christmas of 1986. So when I was homeless, basically, I was living for a while in a hotel in San Francisco, the Golden Eagle. Anybody know the Golden Eagle? Golden Eagle. Lots of people in the light well of the Golden Eagle yelling, fuck, all day long. I stayed there for a few weeks, and then I couldn't stand that anymore. So what I did was my parents had really mistakenly given me a key to their typesetting office that they had downtown. So I would go there, I would, you know, just basically schlump around North Beach and the Tenderloin all day long, and then I would wait till everybody was long gone, and I would go into the office, and I knew the alarm code, and I would go and, like, sleep in their back room, and thinking that, of course, I was going to spare them any embarrassment by getting up and getting out of there before they got there, which, of course, I never did, because I was drunk off my ass and couldn't, you know, wake up at any given time. And 'twas the night before Christmas, and I talked to my mom briefly on the phone, and she said, yeah, we left some Christmas for you. And they left me, like, you know, a couple of presents at the office, and it felt like this weird sort of handoff, you know, like, here, we're going to give you some Christmas presents, but for God's sake, stay away from us, was kind of the message. That's about, you know, that's about as low as it got for me. What ended up happening was I ended up back at their house, for which they should get, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize for all that, because I was really messed up by that time, and I was basically I had a job in a print shop, and I was waking up about 5 minutes before I had to go to work, taking cabs to work all the time, because that would give me an extra 10 minutes to sleep it off. Going to work, printing envelopes, going in the bathroom, crying, printing more envelopes, going, crying in the bathroom some more, smoking. Having an Alpine White candy bar for lunch and crying some more and then going home. Then, you know, dinner was like top ramen with a little bit of nutritional yeast in it and screwdrivers until the Avengers came on at 11:30, which was the high point of the day, right? That was it. And I thought life was pretty good. I even took a picture of myself as the Avengers, you know. At 2 o'clock in the morning one night. That's how good my life was. So, you know, I don't know why things change. I don't know why some of us get a chance. I don't know why I got a chance. But I got a chance. And I kept getting chances. And I've had people kind of roll out the carpet for me all along the way. I've had the people who I needed in my life when I needed them. And one of them got me to a meeting in Seattle. The rest, as they say, is sobriety. And and so now I've got a life. And I didn't expect to outlive the Reagan years, so, you know, having a life is kind of weird sometimes. And I don't always know what to do about it. And the only thing that really works for me is remembering that I was dead, that for all intents and purposes, I was on my way out, that I didn't have a life. And so what do you do if you get a life when you didn't have one? Well, you live a life of some kind of gratitude, and so I'm just trying to devote my life to something a little higher than I was doing in 1986. So that pretty much means, unfortunately, that as soon as I hit the ground every morning, it's about service for about 18 hours until I finally read a book about World War I and pass out. That's kind of it. It's kind of tiring right now. It's really, like, there's a lot going on. But it's contact with you guys that makes it work for me. Certainly the step work is like putting me back on an even keel. I'm doing a lot of 11 step stuff now. I'm hanging out with a bunch of goddamn Buddhists in Alameda, and it's all great, but it's contact with you guys that makes this work. It's going to a meeting and going blah blah blah, murder murder, kill kill kill, and you all going ha ha ha, and that's what makes it work, because you know what I'm really talking about. And I haven't met any other group of people that knows my language this way. So welcome to the newcomers. This stuff works. Don't ask me why, just do it. Here's Mary.
Great. Wow, that was short. I'm Mary. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really glad to be here, although I'm very, very nervous. It's a good thing that I'm kind of sick, so I maybe I'm not feeling all this quite as much as I would otherwise. But I get acutely self-conscious when I have to stand up in front of people. I remember when I first started teaching, I thought I was never going to be able to talk in front of these high school kids at Richmond High. And gradually, it got easier. And it should be easy with you guys, but for some reason tonight, I'm still feeling nervous. But I'll just kind of start at the beginning. Gren talked about isolation a little bit at the end of his share. And I grew up primed for isolation. I was the only child of an artist and his wife, and I lived about a mile, well, about a half a mile from the closest house, but miles out of town, in the country, in the San Gabriel Mountains in Southern California. And I had no brothers and sisters, so I had some dogs. I did hang out with dogs. But, and my parents were kind of iconoclastic and, 50s boho beatniks, basically. My dad played the trumpet and piano and painted pictures. And my mom read a lot of Virginia Woolf and was kind of depressed and gardened. And I became a bookworm because, I had to go hiking a ways to meet any other kids. And I had these friends. Whenever I would run away, I did run away a couple of times when I was young. The first time, I think I was about six, and I took some sardines and some saltines with me. And I went to the Browns' house. They had 8 kids, and they had a Mexican mom, and she was dynamite. She was just like, come on in, have some food, you know, just like, she was wonderful, and the kids were wonderful, and they had a goat, and they had a donkey, and they had horses, and, you know, there was always something to do at the Browns' house, and I kind of relieved the isolation that I felt. But, you know, something about that bringing up was that we didn't talk about our feelings very much. You know, that generation of men, my dad was kind of the powerful one in the household, and he was a pretty cool guy, and he loved to party and play games, and he had a good sense of humor, but you never talked about anything that was wrong. If you cried, no good. You know, you just like sucked it up, and he really wanted a son, and I wasn't a boy, but you know, he took me to build gliders with him and go drive the Jeep up and down the hills, and I did a lot of stuff with him. Went out in his boat, fished with him. So, what happened? Did well in school and was quite awkward with other kids because I had to have like one good friend and basically most of the time, and got into some spiritual nature worship early on. You know, I kind of thought I was a wood spirit or something. I spent the best, you know, the times where I felt the most transcendent outdoors, I'd say. And I also did a lot of body surfing, and we used to go down to the beach in the summers. And so when I was in like 7th grade, my dad's painting kind of took off, and they decided they were going to move. He got some good reviews in the LA Times, and he was in Life magazine. They decided they were going to move to the beach. He was going to quit teaching at this college that he taught at to make a living. And so they took off, and I went with them for the summer. They had a house in Laguna, and but I came back to live with another family for my 8th grade year, another artist. And so that was interesting. And I just see them off and on, you know, on weekends, and went back for the summer, went to high school for the first time, went to a public school, and the school was so easy. I mean, I had done everything they were doing in 9th grade and 6th grade, and I started looking around for what to do, and I started hanging out with the stoners. And then my dad said, I'm leaving your mom, you know, we're getting a divorce. And I went to live with yet another family that summer, and then I moved back to the town I came from with my mom, who was devastated, who drank a fifth of bourbon every day and some beer. And I didn't want to be like her. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. She was miserable. She could never remember what I told her. I would try to talk to her, and I would try to cheer her up at night. You know, that doesn't work anyway. And so I decided I would use drugs. I mean, I tried. I drank. The first time I really got drunk, I drank like 3/4 of a bottle of Jim Beam, and I don't like bourbon. I just don't like bourbon. I never liked bourbon again after that. So I started smoking weed and taking acid, and that was, I worked doing with some friends, some other kids, doing the light show for a blues band, and and then she started noticing that there were these weird smells coming out of my room, that I wasn't getting back by 10 o'clock at night. And so she's like, I'm going to send you to boarding school. So I went off to a boarding school when I was 16, and basically that was it. I never really came home after that. It was up in the mountains in Colorado, which was good for me because I learned how to backpack. I learned how to kayak a little bit. I was out, and I made some very close friends, some of whom are still friends to this day. And then, you know, I loved languages. There was something about that time, I guess I felt like I had had so many changes in my life, it seemed like to me, that my goal, I think, was to kind of pass under and fit in with people because I had to be able to get together with new people pretty frequently. And I was taking French and Spanish. I decided I would work in Europe, so I found a job in the back of a magazine, and I went to the French Alps, and I worked in a 3-star hotel. The first time I got exposed to really good French cooking, which was cool. And I worked 6 days a week, so I didn't have a whole lot of time to travel around, but I made a living. You know, my dad had a big work ethic, and so I was able to, you know, pay my way over there and back. And then I came up to Cal. And Berkeley in 1969, it was really on. I wanted to, I had applied to NYU and I'd gotten in, and I would have liked to go to the Village, but I didn't have the money. You know, my mom couldn't pay for it. And back then, Berkeley was cheap. It didn't even have tuition. It was $125 a quarter. Read it in a week. It was registration fees. And up and down the avenue, you could walk and be stoned just from walking down the street. You know, people were handing you joints and anything else you wanted. And so I was like, wow, there's nobody looking out for me at all. And so I was still getting stoned, mostly. Didn't drink much, you know. There wasn't great stuff to drink around. Although that summer, the next summer, I went up to Tahoe and worked as a maid and as a cook, you know, because there weren't a lot of illegal immigrants in those days. So, or, you know, the college kids did all the work. And I do remember taking Quaaludes and drinking wine and crawling through the meadows up there and, you know, being really fucked up. You know, it was still fun, you know? It was okay. I could recover. I was one of those drinkers. Nobody told me till later that if you can drink a lot and hold your liquor, then maybe that's a sign of alcoholism. And I was the one, you know, later on who was cooking food for people at 3:00 in the morning when the bars closed and driving people home. And anyway, I didn't really start drinking until I lived in France the next year. And I stayed there. I went to North Africa. I did a lot of stuff that my own kids have said to me, why are you so worried about what we do? Look at what you did, you know. And I hitchhiked across Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco and smuggled hash in my shoes and took ferries and, you know, did a lot of stuff. But that year, toward the end of that year, it started to go downhill. I was drinking, you know, it was 60 cents for a bottle of wine. You just take your bottle down to the wine shop downstairs and they'd fill it from a barrel. And so I drank a lot of wine. I got hepatitis, and you weren't supposed to drink, so I just went back to the psychedelics and the hash and stuff. But anyway, it started to be, I started getting depressed. I started being disappointed in people. I started feeling kind of lousy about myself because I wasn't, I guess I was getting fear, you know. I was starting to get, the alcohol was, had become a really habitual way of coping. So if something unpleasant would start to come up, get stoned, get some alcohol, and you don't feel it, you know. And but it started to be a problem, and I started disappointing people around me continually, and then I started disappointing myself. I came back here. I don't know how I graduated from Cal. I was loaded all the time. I had to make an amends to a professor there later on, and because I hadn't translated all these articles that I was supposed to translate for him, and it became apparent when I was making this amends that he didn't even really remember that he had paid me money to work for him, and I hadn't done the work. He probably had a lot of disappointing students. Anyway, so from age 23, when I got done, I started working. There weren't any teaching jobs. I thought about becoming a teacher at the time, but, you know, there was like a baby unboom, and so there was no kids, and so the teachers weren't getting hired. So I started working in restaurants, and I discovered that I loved cooking, and I liked the whole scene. And the first restaurant I worked at, well, part of your pay was two beers at the end of your shift. And so, you know, I'd drink the beers with my buddies, and we'd go down the street to the bar down the street and play pool, and that was okay. But then I just started getting stuck in, like, doing that all the time. And bad stuff started to happen, you know. I got held up at knife point in my own apartment. I'm not like Fitz, I didn't crash every car I ever owned, but my cars were beaters. They had a lot of dents in them. I was always bumping into things. So. I'm trying to think. So I hooked up with this guy who, you know, I picked him right out of the room at the bar. I just looked at him and I'm like, that guy is gorgeous, you know. And turns out he's a junkie on a Geographic from the East Coast. He came out here so, you know, he wouldn't have the heroin around all the time, and he drank. And we drank together. And for a while, it was pretty functional. We helped each other out. We lived in a converted garage, grew a lot of weed. I just like, why should I buy it? This is ridiculous. I can grow Sensimilla, so I would grow a couple pounds every year just for us, you know. I had a dog that barked when the kids would try to climb over the fence. It was okay. Anyway, it got worse because I got into coke, and cocaine is a great accelerator of alcoholism. I was staying up all night. I would think about coke, and I would have to call my dealer. You know, it was just like the reactivity that's associated with alcoholism and addiction became the major, you know, characteristic of how I dealt with the world. And at a certain point, I was shaking. I was drinking so much that I was shaking every morning when I woke up. I tried not to drink. I mean, on weekends, I had a fishing boat, right? So I'm going out the gate for salmon or striped bass, and getting up at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m., you go out there and you can start drinking at 10, you know. So I drank all day on the weekends, and I would try to wait till 3 or 4 in the afternoons. And I'll tell you, it got bad for me. I was sick. I had never been sick before. I was blacking out, I'd say, 3 or 4 times a week in the last few years of my drinking. Oh, I didn't mention, my dad died when I was 24, and so he left me a house and a lot of artwork, no money. But I was able to rent that house, and I'm surprised I didn't actually lose it through my cocaine addiction, but I didn't. It was probably because it was too far away. It would have been too much trouble to sell it. You know, I didn't feel that. I remember climbing in an upstairs window in his house and going to the liquor cabinet after he killed himself, and he had cancer. He was going to die in 3 weeks anyway. And just the liquor cabinet was full. There was a pound of of weed in there, and to deal with the chemo. And I went out. I didn't want to feel it, because I was, you know, I really loved him. And it had been hard for me when he left when I was 15, and I rarely saw him after that, you know, a weekend now and then, a couple times a year, I guess. Sometimes I'd go down there for a week. So there was a lot of abandonment stuff that I never allowed myself to feel. And when the man I lived with, I'd been with him for 4 years, told me, you know, I don't think I want to live with you anymore. You're like crazy, or you're an alcoholic or something. You ought to go to AA or see a shrink. And that got my attention. Because, and he said, you're like Jekyll and Hyde when you drink now. I don't know if you're going to start a fight in the bar, what you're going to do. You know, I had started disappearing with other guys. I was a mess. And I had no self-esteem. I was waking up every morning shaking, and I had purple spots under my eyes. I'd had episodes where I had, be drinking scotch all night, and he'd be asleep. I'd be still drinking scotch and snorting coke and falling on the ground and bleeding from the nose. You know, it was not pretty. I said, okay, well, I'll try to do something. And I'm thinking to myself, I know I'm not crazy. I graduated from Cal. I should go to maybe I'll check out AA. But I had never heard anybody talk about alcoholism. And I grew up in a pretty hard-drinking society of all these painters. And I went to meetings. There used to be a care unit at Alta Bates. So I went to my first meeting in November of 1980. Or actually in the spring before that, and I did not feel at home. There were a lot of older white guys with white plastic wristbands, and they, you know, the Christianity, the prayers, it really made me feel uncomfortable. And the third time I went, though, I did buy a big book. People were welcoming. I bought a big book, and I go home and I smoked weed and I read it. the third time, though, there was this young woman, I think she came over from Sausalito or something, and she told my story, you know, really, a lot of it. She talked about waking up with guys that she barely knew and going, what have I done, you know? She talked about blackouts. She talked about walking into furniture and reaching her hand up and feeling blood on her face. I mean, so much of this humiliating, stupid stuff that happens to us, she had gone through, and she was laughing. She looked good, you know. She was able to be completely honest and accept herself, and it was okay. And I'm like, wow. And I went up and I talked to her afterwards, and I said, you know, I don't really know if I'm an alcoholic or not. She said, well, there's a way to find out. You can go out and try to do some controlled drinking. You know, try to drink 2 glasses of wine. You like to hear music, go out and do that. But if you're a real alcoholic and you start drinking again, it's probable that within a very short time, you'll be right back where you are now, and worse. It could be worse. And I know people don't like you to talk about telling people to go out and drink now, but because they die. And I'd already had a couple of friends that died by that time. But so I took it to heart. But you know what? I just wasn't convinced. I hadn't admitted to my innermost self, like it says in the book, that alcohol, I could no longer control it. I still thought maybe I could drink like a gentlewoman. So I found myself at the White Horse liquor store getting 2 Budweisers one night after I'd been sober for 28 days. I'd been stoned, but I'd been sober. And she was right. It got worse. And I remember that during that summer, drinking and wanting to stop and not being able to stop and waking up with my pain on my right side. I knew my liver was there. And I remember like one night going, I need help. But not being a religious person, I didn't know what I was asking. I just knew I needed some help. And I didn't get it right away. But, you know, I sometimes think that something happened then, because I really just got to the point where I had given up. And there was a night in the fall where I drank, and it wasn't any worse than any, especially worse than another one, except I remember coming to at about 3 o'clock in the morning in my regular bar, kissing this bartender that was a Republican, that was way younger than me, whose Corvette I had stolen one night to go joyriding. And I'm like, ah, oh, fuck, what am I doing, you know? And then I don't remember anything. Then I got home, I woke up the next morning, my car was kind of crooked out there, but it was there. And I was in chef school by that time. And I went to go to San Francisco. I used to like drive up to the Rockridge BART and get in my and walk across and get on the train. Well, I was shaken so bad that I couldn't walk across that overpass. And I thought, I gotta do something. And I really didn't know if AA would work for me. But I decided to go back to a meeting, but I was so sick that I went and got a couple of beers and went the next day. And central office was down at 2910 Telegraph then, and it was upstairs, and you could smoke in there, and that place was so smoky in those rooms, but it was what I needed. Someone stayed and talked to me for like 45 minutes after that first meeting. Someone who was totally understanding and totally welcoming. And, you know, it was like, I believed her. She said, you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to believe in anything. All you have to know is we're a bunch of alcoholics. We've been sober longer than you. Some people there have been sober for 3 months. I was like, 3 months? How could you do that? You know, she had been sober for 3 years. And she said, just do it one day at a time. Just do it one day at a time. And I'm going to give you my phone number, and I want you to get other people's phone numbers. And just call us. If things are not going well, if you feel like drinking, call us first. You know, I know people always think it's better to call later, but we have a lot of pride. And so I did. I mean, I just took it on faith. What else can you do? I didn't want to be the woman I was that was drinking. And so, you know, it wasn't a... I used to say I had a really high bottom, because I did, you know. I didn't lose it all, you know. I still had some jeans and T-shirts and a couple sweatshirts and a couple pairs of shoes and... a boyfriend, such as he was, and a nice garage to live in, and I was okay. But I didn't feel okay inside. And so what going to a meeting every day did for me was to open up my perspective a little bit and to let me look at other people and really see them as human beings. You know, there wasn't any Berkeley Fellowship back then. I used to go out to El Cerrito because I was, you know, in chef school and working in the late morning till 10 o'clock at night, and there was a 9 a.m. meeting, and I needed it because I was, you know, coping with the feelings that come up when you haven't dealt with any of your feelings for 10 or 15 years, if not longer, isn't easy. And it's like, I would never know what was going to come up. And I go there, and there were just great people there, you know. There was Bob H. Bob H. used to start every share and he'd say, "My name is Bob and I'm a practicing human being." And I just loved that because it meant I didn't have to be perfect, that I had flaws and everybody had flaws. And I got to see people going through their stuff and changing and getting better. And there was somebody there who, Margaret, used to say, your life is like an elevator. Your alcoholism is like an elevator. You can get off at any floor. You don't have to end up in prison. Once you recognize the fact that your life is unmanageable and you can't control what happens after you take the first drink. You know, that whole first drink concept is kind of weird, too, because I'm like, well, sometimes I can drink 7, and sometimes I can drink 10, and sometimes I can drink a whole bottle. But the truth is, it's the first drink that sets that inexorable process in line going on that makes it so you don't know where the hell you're going to end up. That first year, you know, they told us, don't change anything the first year. So I stayed with my boyfriend, and it was like a chemical, weird chemical balance. You know, I got sober, and then I started trying to stop smoking weed, and he just like going down, 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 shooting up more and more and more, and kicking and shooting up again. And, you know, finally I'm like, I had some sanity. I did my first steps. I did my first fourth step. I did my first fifth step, but not with my sponsor because I thought she was way too nice a lady to hear some of the nasty stuff I had done. So I told it to my friend Ava, who's the kind of woman that she told me a great story one time about being in a cop car out in Concord and talking into her high-heeled shoe like Get Smart. Yeah, she was a blackout drinker like me. And then we burned my fourth step out on Treasure Island and let all the ashes fly up there. And, you know, I didn't feel that immediate relief that people talk about. I just felt exhausted, letting go. And that first fifth step was a lot about letting go, fourth and fifth step, a lot about letting go of events, things I had done. It wasn't about the nature of my wrongs. I don't think I could even get to that yet, you know. I could, until I let go of all that stuff, I couldn't really look at, well, what are the kind of characteristics, the personality, those clusters of, you know, reactions. What is that that I do all the time that continually causes me problems? You know, basically selfishness. So that happened. And then, you know, I think I kind of skipped over the sixth and seventh step. I didn't do that this time. I mean, we read it in the book. The big book doesn't have a whole lot about the sixth and seventh step. It's really kind of short. And I did ninth step amends to the best of my ability with people I could find. There's still a few people I'd like to make amends to from back in my drinking days, and I don't even know if they're still alive or where they are. But I got into service at 6 months. I remember, Melanie's not here tonight, but Julian used to call me. There were three Marys in Berkeley and El Cerrito AA then, and he used to call me. They'd go, "Which Mary was that?" "Oh, the crying cook," because I came apart at the seams. I cried all the time my first year. I remember thinking about it and thinking like, this is like a frozen river in Colorado in May, and it just, the ice starts breaking and the rocks are and I just felt like I was coming apart. I didn't know who I was. What was this person, you know? And I came to find out that a new life is possible, and every day we make a new life based on the choices that we make and, you know, the actions that we take. And that's why the 11th step is so important to me today, And I hang out with the Buddhists too. You got a pair of us up here tonight. And, you know, I've gone through some stuff in the last few years, and that radically changed my life. And I thought I was losing my whole family, and I kind of was for a while. And I was really at sea. And a really dear friend of mine now came to me and he said, "Hey, Mary, I want you to go to this beginning meditation meeting with me." And he took me, and just, I learned how to sit still. And I learned how to sit still and experience what was coming up and not take it so personally, because there's a lot of fear, anger, and desire. Those three things in various forms come up for me all the time. And I didn't even, you know, back in the very early days of sobriety, I didn't even know what it was a lot of the time. But, you know, we talk about resentments, that's anger. Fear, I couldn't even admit fear when I got here. I would say, "Oh, I'm feeling a little anxious," you know. I was a tough guy. I was a, you know, I couldn't admit vulnerability. And when I started to come apart, it was really hard for me. But people accepted me. And so acceptance of one another is another really big thing in the rooms that I find is so wonderful. We're all so different, you know, but we've got this one thing that's alike. You know, we just react with the, "I need something," you know. And I think alcoholics are very sensitive people, and I think they're very intelligent people in many, you know, unless we've like totally smashed our heads up too many times. But, you know, I love alcoholics. I like hanging out with alcoholics. And, you know, there's something about the community. When you go sit at a Buddhist meditation hall, they say, "I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha." The Sangha is the community of people. The Buddha is the awakened self within, the possibility of awakening. And the Dharma is kind of the law. It's the laws of how things work. And, you know, that was the one that kind of puzzled me. And I think about it now, and I always think about that line from the Big Book. It says, "We finally have made decisions based on self." You know, if you make decisions based on self and you try to direct the play and all the actors and everybody in it, they react against you. You know, if you try to control people, it doesn't go your way. And I found that, you know, learning to just like watch those desires to do that, to try to control and make everything go the way I want it to go, is probably the most counterproductive thing I can do, because I can only be in the moment. I can only change if I can look and say, "Hey, what do I want to do right now?" A lot of times, you know, I might get pissed off at something someone does, or I might get really frightened about what I think they're going to do. But if I can just be right there and go, and let that move through me and ask whatever higher power I have for help, I can just go, "Okay, that's all right. I'll trust. I can let it be. And I know the right thing to do." You know, there's that section that says, you know, we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And I'm not saying you don't have to cry and scream and talk to your sponsor and you know, dump a lot of stuff or write, but there comes a point where you know what's the right thing to do for you. And I I'm really a believer in literature meetings. I don't know if there are as many of them around as there used to be, but it was really important to me to go to a big book study, to go to a step study, because I think you need that stuff in your head. I think you need our voices in your head. I remember at 9 months, I went off to Europe, and I went back to Bordeaux, where I lived with to visit the family, my wine broker family over there. And there weren't any meetings except in Paris and Cannes. There were only meetings in places that had a high percentage of English-speaking people then. And so I just would go in cathedrals and just try to sit and pray. And no Skype either, so I couldn't talk to my sponsor. My mom got cancer while I was over there. And also, I got in a situation where I was taken out to dinner, and the people I was with knew I didn't drink, and I made it really clear to this guy, I don't drink alcohol anymore. And every single course, "You're a chef, try this wine, this is just great." And I had heard that usually it's other alcoholics that push you like that. And I was able to just say, "No thanks, no thank you, no thank you, no thank you." But there's that line, there will come a time, where no human power can help you. And what it was for me was what was inside of my head from meetings, what was inside of my head from reading the book and from listening, it really did a lot for me. It kept me from drinking that night. And I don't know why I have that grace, to not drink. But what I do know is that it's allowed me to live a life, I married somebody in the program. I had two children. I never thought anybody would ever I was a relatively attractive young woman, but I never thought anybody would marry me. I had no self-esteem. I went back to school, I got a master's degree, I became a teacher, I got a couple of different credentials in that. I got to work at a high school with kids who were just tremendous. That taught me so much. And I was always drawn to the alcoholic kids. If they were my buddies, I could spot one, I had a boy whose mother had been beaten to death by his drunken stepfather in front of him, and we just recognized each other right away, and I was able to get him into counseling. There've been a lot of rewards. It's not an easy thing to work full time, to have children, to be involved in AA, and I did get far from the program for some of those years. It's hard, the child rearing years, and I wish, sometimes I wish I had taken more time for myself to get to more meetings. I think it would have made my marriage better. It probably would have made me be a better parent. But what is done, and all I have is today. It's the end of the meeting, kind of. I've been thinking about, it's the end of the year. It's the summer, this winter solstice is going to be pretty soon, and I can't wait. I can't wait till it starts being light a little bit later in the day. But this is a good time of year to think about what we want to let go of. And thank God alcohol and drugs are something that we have the possibility of letting go of really easily, but we can let go of them with each other's help. And you know, with the literature that's available to us and with the sincere belief that, you know, we're powerless. We're really powerless, and we don't need to be powerful. Every time I want to get powerful, or I see people around me thinking that they're powerful, that they're rich, that they've got it all together, that's when they're just like starting to get fucked up, you know? So I've been thinking about what is it I want to let go of, and what is it that I hope for the new year? You know, there's a lot of people here. I don't know. Maybe you guys can think about that. I think that you should dream big, you know? What is it that you want to do in this coming year? And write it down. Because, you know, I've been surprised. I've done that a few times in the new year, and it's come true. It's really come true. So I think I'm gonna stop. I wish all of you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And I hope you find something that gives you a lot of hope and you have fun together. Thanks.
I'd like to re-welcome the newcomers and visitors. Thanks a lot for coming. And let's thank tonight's speaker, Mary. And please do, won't you help me close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
Say the wee version of the Serenity Prayer after a moment of silence for those inside and outside these rooms who are still suffering. God
grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back into our rooms.